From Maine to Arizona, Washington to Missouri, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court's Chevron decision struck a blow at the power of the deep state. But now Congress must act to reclaim its legislative authority. Phil Kirpin of American Commitment is here to discuss. The first and possibly only presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is Tuesday. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story on what's at stake. People are policy. If reelected, will Donald Trump be able to find the people he needs to enact his agenda? Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine report. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s endorsement of Donald Trump is entirely consistent with his family's legacy. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains why on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a landmark ruling in the Chevron case that curtailed the power of the deep state to adjudicate its own regulations. But now Congress must take the next step to fully restore constitutional balance. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He is here to explain why and how. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, a couple of months back, the Supreme Court of the United States in the Chevron ruling held that bureaucratic agencies cannot judge their own regulations. This would seem, and it's being celebrated by conservatives as a big win to try to claw back power from the deep state. But is that in and of itself enough to get the job done?
Loman, no, I don't think it is. And I'm not trying to minimize the importance of that decision in the two cases, Loper, Bright, and Relentless, that overturned the Chevron doctrine, because it is a huge deal, because for 40 years we were dealing with this problem where when you sued a federal agency, you almost always lost because of this huge sum on the scale where unless they were arbitrary and capricious, the courts would defer to them as the supposed experts. So that is a big deal, but it doesn't solve the problem in and of itself because it substitutes the judgment of unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats with the judgment of unelected judges. And they shouldn't be the arbiters of economic policy either. Really, Congress should be. They're the people who are elected to make these decisions. They're the branch under our Constitution that is supposed to be vested with all of the legislative power. And so if Congress just says, problem solved, we don't need to do anything about regulation, the court fixed it, they're completely missing the point. And what they instead should be saying is, this is great that we're no longer acting like regulators are the bureaucrat kings who are the world experts who are going to decide everything, but now we, the people's elected officials, are going to develop the expertise and the knowledge to actually make the important economic policy decisions ourselves. That's what I'd like to see.
That brings up the so-called REINS Act, R-E-I-N-S. For our listeners who may not have heard us talk about this in the past, tell us what REINS stands for and what would the REINS Act do?
It's the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. They love doing these acronyms. I think they're a little silly myself, but every bill, they name it something and then they fit words to fit the letters. And so that's what that one stands for, but this bill has an amazing backstory. It didn't come out of a think tank or the usual suspects in Washington. It actually came from a retired former local elected official in northern Kentucky, Campbell County, Kentucky, Cincinnati suburbs, whose water bill doubled as a result of an EPA regulation. And he took his water bill and his U.S. Constitution. The guy's name was Lloyd Rogers. His congressman at the time was Jeff Davis. He took his water bill and his U.S. Constitution to a town hall meeting, and he walks up to the congressman. He says, "Congressman, this is my water bill. This is my Constitution. The Constitution says all legislative power is vested in the Congress. The water bill says the EPA made the bill double. How does the EPA do that without you voting on it? All legislative power is supposed to be vested in you." And the congressman really didn't have an answer except say, "I think you're right." And he went back to Washington, and he asked his staff to develop a bill to fix this problem. And the bill they wrote was the REINS Act. And what it says is that instead of agencies being able to impose regulations directly on the American people, on the economy, they should have to write it out, send it to Congress as a proposal, and Congress should have to vote on it first, then it should only take effect if it can command a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate and either a presidential signature or a veto override. So in other words, Lohman, under the RAINS Act, for any economically significant agency action, we would have to follow the constitutional process of passing laws.
This RAINS Act has been kicking around for a while. It's passed the House a couple of times, hasn't it, but never quite made it through the Senate?
Yeah, I want to say it's passed the House about five or six times, including twice in the current Congress. And in the current Congress, it's passed both as standalone legislation, and it was part of the Limit Save Grow Act, which was the first volley of the big debt ceiling showdown with Kevin McCarthy and Biden. And, of course, it ended up coming out, and it wasn't in the final bill. But that was kind of an important marker because I don't think we're ever going to pass it by itself. I think if we ever get this done, it'll be as part of a must-pass bill that the Democrats in the Senate don't dare to filibuster. We've never been able to get a Senate vote on this legislation, largely because the Democrats have taken the position that our legislators shouldn't make the most important economic policy decisions, that the agencies are more expert and more effective and more knowledgeable, and it's a good thing in their mind that so much power has been punted from Congress to these regulatory agencies. And so they do not want this to pass. And in fact, we may be moving a little bit backwards in the Senate because Joe Manchin was a co-sponsor in previous Congresses. He was the only Senate Democrat who was a co-sponsor, and he's not, the last time I checked, a co-sponsor in the current Congress. And so I don't know if he just didn't remember to do it or if he actually no longer supports it. But we have had challenges in the Senate. And, you know, the other thing that people have told me for years is, they say you'll never get a president to sign this because they like using the agencies to move their agenda and get around Congress, and they would never reduce their own power. But we got really good statements of support from basically all the Republican presidential candidates, including President Trump. So I think that at least on the Republican side, there's an understanding that this is a process you want to fix on a permanent basis, even if that means in the near term a little bit less executive power.
Isn't it unusual in Washington, Phil, for any agency or any legislative body to want to hand away power? Usually they try to protect their power, gather it unto them. Why in the world would Congress want to be giving away such a significant part of their constitutional powers?
Well, I think that what's happened over this has been going on for decades, but I think that what's happened is that members of Congress have discovered that if you pass broad, vague laws, you can claim credit for your wonderful good intentions and any good results that happen. But as long as the details and the specifics are punted to an agency, you can disclaim blame for any of the bad things that happen. And so they've set up a system where all of the details and all of the specifics get punted to the bureaucrats, and they can claim credit for their wonderful good intentions and deflect blame when things go awry. And that seems to suit a lot of members of Congress, unfortunately.
The wonderful world of Washington, D.C. We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil, of course, is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment. Also, all of these issues, you write a lot about them. Where can folks find that information?
The website's AmericanCommitment.org. Everything is on there. I'm also a little bit of an ex-addict, if people want my minute-to-minute thoughts. It's my last name, Kirpin, K-E-R-P-E-N. On X. And what American Commitment, we're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. And mostly we focus on kind of the big issue of the day where maybe getting citizens a little more educated and engaged might tip the outcome in a more free market direction. So we do lots of vote alerts when there are upcoming floor votes on significant issues that could go either way, or letters into regulatory agencies when that might make a difference. But we've got a few things that are long-term priorities that we kind of always beat the drum for, and I would say at the top of that list is the RAINS Act we've been talking about, and we have passed it many times in the House, and we've made progress with the presidential candidates, and we're hoping that we'll make progress in the Senate also. And I will note that you have a very clear contrast on this issue in the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania, and I know you're carried nationally as well, and in almost all of the races, maybe in all of them, where we've surveyed the Senate candidates, we've got strong statements of support from the Republicans, and we have them from, for instance, McCormick and Moreno, and we've not got statements of support from the Democrats. They've either ignored us completely or pointed us to public statements of opposition to this, and there's a pretty clear partisan divide in the Senate races on this.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Lohman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on all the preparations, all the run-up to the big presidential debate that's going to take place on Tuesday evening. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Well, the debate's upcoming, and a big night, especially for Kamala Harris, who has a lot to prove. Your take on that?
Well, you know, when you go back to the first debate, a lot of people say that, you know, the folks tuning in aren't really going to be swing voters, that they're hyper-partisans, that are really, really interested in seeing their own candidate perform well, and they always have raving reviews in support of whoever they prefer at the presidential ballot. But in that first debate, listen, we obviously had a big, big moment there. A lot of people, for the first time, recognized the inabilities and just really the level of incompetence that Joe Biden was suffering from as he continues to age. And in the intervening period, Joe Biden turned over that nomination to his Vice President Kamala Harris. So this on September 10th, on Tuesday, is going to be the real first opportunity for a lot of Americans to engage with Kamala Harris and see what she's got to say about the most pressing issues that America faces. This week, the Harris campaign finally relented over this controversy and whether or not the microphones were going to remain muted. That was an agreement that the Biden and Trump campaigns made with the networks heading into the debates earlier this summer. But Kamala wanted to change that because they obviously were trying to goad Donald Trump into a gaffe or interrupting Kamala Harris. You might remember from the 2020 election when Mike Pence and Kamala Harris were debating each other. Harris got interrupted by Pence and she said, "Excuse me, Vice President, I am speaking," right? And like she wanted that moment with Donald Trump, but they apparently received assurances that if there is significant crosstalk between Harris and Trump, that they're going to unmute the microphones. So we'll see how that shakes out on Tuesday. But I think the big issue here, Loman, is that Kamala Harris is perceived to be a moderate by far too many Americans, according to new polls. And the reality is that she's just as extreme as Bernie Sanders and AOC.
So there has been a recent spate of polling that's come out, and it would appear, Scott, that in the minds of many voters, Kamala is still relatively undefined.
Yeah, there's six polls that came out from CNN this week. Start out with the caveat that it only included registered voters, not likely voters. So that's a big methodological anomaly that we don't normally see in polling. But I think that they wanted to demonstrate that Kamala was leading in all these swing states, which is what the CNN polls showed. They asked this question about whether or not Donald Trump's views and policies were generally mainstream or too extreme or so extreme that they pose a threat to the United States. Comparatively, in states like Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Kamala's views were the ones that were viewed as generally mainstream. I think that it's a real opportunity to really define Kamala Harris and those extreme policies that she does support. You know, they are fully supportive of the Biden budget, which calls for $7 trillion in tax increases. When you take into consideration that they want the Trump tax cuts to fully expire, all these policies together would lead to economic ruin. I think that it's important for folks to really peel back the layers of the onion and understand what a Harris presidency would mean. Joe Biden became the most liberal president of my lifetime, far to the left of Barack Obama, insofar that he wasn't really running things. And the big question in D.C. is who has been running White House for the last 3 years. I think that it's Harris and the regime behind her that are so radical that, you know, have completely lost touch with the middle class and are disconnected from these voters that really have no political home anymore. The independent on the political spectrum now is a part of the center right. The center left has become this like, oh my gosh, where do we land now? Now, of course, when it comes down to the D or the R next to a name on a presidential ticket, there's going to be people that no matter what are going to vote for the Democrat or vote for the Republican. But when you get down to those bellwether counties in rural Pennsylvania or in the suburbs of Pennsylvania, these things can be decided by just a few thousand votes. And when you're fighting over that middle, that's going to tip the scale for the 2024 elections.
Kamala Harris, of course, during her brief run for president back in 2019 as a U.S. senator, staked out many far-left positions, even to the left of Bernie Sanders here, Scott. She's trying to flip-flop on all of them. Any chance the debate moderators at ABC are going to hold her accountable for those flip-flops?
Yeah, if you look at Dana Bash's interview with Waltz and Harris from a week or so ago, they didn't really press her when they asked, right? And she basically says her policies might have shifted, but that her fundamental ideology has not. And I think that it is important that we recognize that the California liberalism that is so far out of touch with the mainstream on policy and approach and tone and the state of preserving our American sovereignty from border issues down to, you know, becoming a socialist state. We know that Kamala stands for all of that, and she will fundamentally change America, and I think that we'll suffer for it if she becomes president of the United States.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, and Scott, as always, a few words about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. If you want to check out the mainstream pro-growth economic freedom ideas that we stand for, you can visit us at clubforgrowth.org and sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Next week's conversation is going to be really interesting. Scott, we'll check in with you then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Donald Trump will need true MAGA believers and policy experts to enact his agenda if he is successful in returning to the White House. Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine explain why.
If there are any two beliefs that are shared by both critics and admirers of former President Donald Trump, it is these, writes Reason's Stephanie Slade in the latest issue of the magazine. His whims were frequently hamstrung by the people who surrounded him during his first term, and that won't be allowed to happen again. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Stephanie Slade, senior editor at Reason Magazine, and she joins us to discuss her cover story, Project 2025 is No Match for MAGA Dysfunction, is the headline there. Slade, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
I actually want to skip from the top of the piece right down to the bottom, actually, though, where you point out that Democrats are really trying hard to paint Project 2025 as part of a playbook for Trump to kind of become a dictator on day one. You're pretty skeptical of that reading of Project 2025 and of Trump's agenda, if we can call it that.
That's right. Yeah. So I guess the first question is, what is Project 2025? And in brief, this is it kind of has two parts. It's headed up by the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and it has two parts. One is like a 900-page policy agenda that, of course, Democrats are saying is going to do all kinds of horrible things, many of which are just plain old conservative or free market things that Republicans have been saying they want to do forever. But the other thing, the other component of Project 2025 is a personnel database. And the idea here is that in order for Trump to be able to take his will and put it into practice as president, he needs to have people around him, his cabinet secretaries, his political appointees, right, his staffers in the White House. The people around him need to be 100% loyal to him and his vision. And we can't have any more of these Beltway establishment conservative free market types that come in here and sabotage his trying to get the MAGA agenda enacted. So we need to make sure that we have a database full of people who are fully vetted, fully loyal to Donald Trump, and will do whatever he says. You know, when he jumps, they say how high. There's no asking questions. There's no challenging him on things. It's how do we make sure that those people are the ones who get hired into these jobs if he is reelected? And that's what the second part of Project 2025 is this personnel thing, this idea of we need to get the right people who are Trump MAGA loyalists in those jobs if he's going to be able to get his way. So the question I wanted to answer with this piece was, you know, is that likely to actually work? And I think there are some pretty good reasons for being skeptical to think that, you know, skeptical about the idea that this is actually going to play out the way Heritage Foundation or the critics, the Trump critics who are, you know, saying that it's a blueprint for making him a dictator are saying it's going to play out.
Yeah, I think the point here is that mostly that, you know, Trump would just be actually prepared to run the federal bureaucracy this time around if he gets into office instead of last time where it seemed like the, you know, they were kind of caught by surprise that he had won the election. I wonder, you know, okay, you work for Reason Magazine. I work for Reason Magazine. We're libertarians. On one hand, like the idea of slashing and burning the federal bureaucracy and using, you explain exactly what Schedule F is, because that's something that comes up in this piece and something that's prominent in this plan. But the idea of using the power of the presidency to do some serious damage to the federal bureaucracy is in some ways appealing to me. And in fact, in a lot of ways appealing to me. Why is that maybe not going to happen the way Trump's loyalists think it might happen?
The main thing is that you need to have people who not just are loyal, if you want to actually get anything done, you've got to have people in these jobs who not just are loyal to Trump, but who actually know what they're doing. They know how the government works. They understand the ins and outs of policy, the policies that they're trying to implement. And the problem is that there just aren't that many people out there who are both knowledgeable and competent and have experience in government and know these policies and who are loyal to Trump. Now, this is not unique to Trump. You know, there's not that many people who have competence in these issues to begin with. But the idea that we can, you know, the first time around, Donald Trump could not even manage to find enough people to fill the 4,000 spots in the federal government that every president gets to fill when he comes in, he or she comes in and takes office. There are about 4,000 political appointments that a president gets to fill. And Trump couldn't find enough people to fill those spots. And a lot of the people that he did end up appointing ended up not being loyal to his vision. So the idea that he could go out there and find 4,000 or 50,000, which is what some people are saying could happen, people that are going to be, you know, 100% on board with his vision, loyal to him, and who know what they're doing, and so they can actually take these policy ideas and implement them, put them into practice, actually accomplish things, seems completely crazy.
We're talking with Stephanie Slade, senior editor at Reason Magazine, about her latest cover story. Project 2025 is no match for MAGA dysfunction is the headline here. Slade, not a lot of time left here, but I guess I'm going to ask you to just speculate a little bit here. Let's think about, okay, if Trump does win the election and we go into the transition period and they're trying to staff up, they're trying to replace people in the bureaucracy, is this piece, is your argument here basically an argument for broadening the Trump coalition? Like, look, you guys are going to have to find the free marketers, find the establishment conservatives to fill these positions, because otherwise there's not going to be anybody there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a sort of inevitability. Is if you want to have people that know how to actually accomplish an agenda, you're going to have to find people who have experience in government and who have experience, you know, who have worked on these policy issues for years. You can't just go out into the country and find people who have their red MAGA trucker hat and think that they're going to be able to implement the agenda. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make in this article is that there's an inherent tension that we can't get away from, we can't avoid, between people who know how to work in government and get things done and who understand the issues, and people who are 100% loyal to Trump. And so there, you know, we recognize, almost everybody recognizes that was a problem with Trump's first term in office. I just don't see any way of getting around that if he ends up with a second term in office, even though everybody on his side really wants, they recognize the problem, they want to solve the problem, but I don't think that they have the resources available to them to actually do it.
Yeah, that tension is something that I think will be difficult for a new Trump administration, if there is another Trump administration, to resolve. We will see how it plays out. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
And again, that's Stephanie Slade, senior editor at Reason Magazine. You can check out her latest cover story in the October 2024 issue of Reason. Project 2025 is no match for MAGA dysfunction. That's the headline there. Check it out online at reason.com. While you're there, also check out the new season of my podcast, my Reason podcast, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. That's the title of the podcast. In the first episode, I talked to Mark Cuban about why prescription drugs are so expensive in the United States and what he's doing to try to change that. Find that, again, that podcast at reason.com and on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your pods. For Reason, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s endorsement of Donald Trump was a major development in the 2024 presidential campaign. But on this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, says it was consistent with family tradition. Paul?
The Kennedys have dominated American politics unlike any other family. And that's no small statement. First, there was the Adams family. No, not the TV sitcom. But that is John and John Quincy, the first father-son presidents. The mother, likewise, was brilliant. Abigail Adams was a force to be reckoned with. Then there were the Roosevelts, Teddy, Franklin, Eleanor. More recently, the Bushes, another father-son presidential pair. But it's hard to surpass the longevity of the Kennedy family, given the sheer number of Joe and Rose progeny that have gone into politics. Joe himself had been a prominent, controversial ambassador. Then came the sons, President John F. Kennedy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and Senator Ted Kennedy. And just when we maybe thought the Kennedy influence was waning, well, here comes RFK Jr. to emerge as an influential figure in the 2024 presidential race. The junior Bobby Kennedy broke from his family's Democratic Party in 2024 to run as an independent, and then, with a blockbuster move, endorse Republican Donald Trump for president. The fact that RFK Jr. didn't endorse the Democratic ticket should hardly be a shock. The way Democrats treated him was nothing short of outrageous. Set aside the fact the liberals over the last few years have trashed the man as an anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist, an anti-science crackpot, and even an anti-Semite. They and the Democratic Party next spent a whole year trying to block RFK Jr. from getting on ballots in state after state, all the while proclaiming to be great champions of democracy. Most egregious, the Biden administration consistently refused to provide RFK Jr. with Secret Service protection, a practice enforced since the assassination of RFK Jr.'s father in June 1968. Sure, they came up with all sorts of excuses justifying Kennedy's lack of protection, but they had no good reason. It was utterly inexcusable. The man faced multiple death threats. Only after Donald Trump was shot in Butler, Pennsylvania, did the Biden administration suddenly provide Kennedy with the protection he needed. Thus, when RFK Jr. decided to endorse the Democrats' opponent in this election, they and the family should not have been shocked. And yet, the family has reacted to the endorsement in a rather shocking way. Leading the charge has been RFK Jr.'s sister, Carrie Kennedy, a very partisan Democrat, who says that her brother's inexplicable support of Trump has, quote, set fire to my father's memory, unquote. Carrie isn't speaking alone. The family immediately issued a press release labeling Bobby Jr.'s endorsement a betrayal. The family said in a statement, "We believe in Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Our brother Bobby's decision to endorse Trump is a betrayal of the values that our father and our family hold most dear. It is a sad ending to a sad story," unquote. But the true story is that Bobby is actually carrying on the tradition of his father, his uncle, and his grandfather, who often crossed party lines to endorse Republicans. In 1950, for example, Bobby and his brother John and their father Joe gave money, campaign contributions, to Republican Richard Nixon when he ran against Democrat nominee Helen Gahagan Douglas for the U.S. Senate seat in California. Longtime prominent liberal and Kennedy historian Chris Matthews writes in his biography, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, that RFK Sr. by 1956 had developed such a, quote, contempt for liberals, unquote, that he voted for Republican Dwight Eisenhower over Democrat Adlai Stevenson. Sure, everyone liked Ike, but liberals have long reviled Republican Senator Joe McCarthy, that is, except for one liberal, Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Sr. started his political career working for Senator Joe McCarthy, a fellow Irish Catholic who Bobby not just respected, but loved. In fact, the whole Kennedy clan liked Joe McCarthy. McCarthy dated one of the Kennedy girls and spent a lot of time with the family at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport. Today's Kennedys need to look more introspectively at their own partisan politics as well as family history. The fact is that RFK Jr. shares the same independent streak that his father and brother and grandfather had. Today's Kennedys might not like that, but it's true. In endorsing a Republican this year, even if Donald Trump, RFK Jr. is not unlike his father. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WSQF-FM in Mansfield, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.